I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 11th of February. Nicholas Kristof recently turned over his column in the New York Times to Dylan Farrow, Woody Allen's adopted daughter. She's now 28 years old, and she accused Woody Allen of molesting her. She said that she has been traumatized for more than two decades by what took place, and last year was belatedly diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. When she heard of the Golden Globe Award being given to Allen, she curled up in a ball on her bed, crying hysterically. Woody Allen responded in the Times on February 7, writing, 21 years ago, when I first heard Mia Farrow had accused me of a child molestation, I found the idea so ludicrous I didn't give it a second thought. We were involved in a terribly acrimonious breakup with great enmity between us and a custody battle slowly gathering energy. He says that he naively thought that the accusation would be dismissed out of hand because he, of course, had not molested Dylan, and any rational person would see the ploy for what it was. And then Dylan responded in The Hollywood Reporter, saying that Allen's op-ed is the latest rehash of the same legalese, distortions, and outright lies that he has leveled at me for the past 20 years. He insists my mother brought criminal charges. In fact, it was a pediatrician who reported the incident to the police based on my firsthand account. Due to the personalities involved, many people have paid close attention to these columns, and importantly, many people are now paying more attention to the issue of child sexual abuse, and that's what we will do this hour of our program. We have two guests with us. Kathleen Russell is Executive Director of the Center for Judicial Excellence in Marin County, California, and she is co-founder and part-time Executive Director of the Center for Judicial Excellence. She advocates on behalf of the Center for Legislative and Administrative Changes that will promote judicial accountability and better protect children's and vulnerable populations' rights in the judicial system. Dr. Joy Silberg is also with us, Senior Consultant for Child and Adolescent Trauma at Shepherd Pratt Health System in Baltimore and Executive Vice President of the Leadership Council on Child Abuse and Interpersonal Violence. She has a psychotherapy practice and specializes in children and adolescents suffering from symptoms and disorders, dissociative symptoms. Her forensic practice specializes in child sexual abuse, and she has served as an expert witness in 27 states. Kathleen, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's great to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you with us. And Joanna Silberg, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I would imagine, of course, the personalities involved make us read these stories, but I would imagine this is an important time for all of us to be learning a great deal more about child sexual abuse. And as I read the material in preparation for the show, I was amazed by some of these statistics. This is an issue that we need to know more about, don't you think, Kathleen?
Yes, Kathleen, and it's really important that your show has decided to tackle the bigger context of the Dylan Farrow and Woody Allen situation, because what Dylan is experiencing right now from her adoptive father is exactly what millions of people in America, children who are child sex abuse survivors, have to deal with, and they obviously don't have the celebrity that gets the kind of attention that this situation has gotten. But what's happening to Dylan is really textbook in terms of what happens in these cases.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised, alarmingly so, Dr. Silberg, by how widespread this is in our society. It's hard to believe this happens to the extent that it does.
Yes, people are very shocked. There have been lots of incidence studies, and one of the classic ones found that one in four girls have experienced some form of sexual abuse, one in six boys. And they've looked at different cultures, different socioeconomic classes, and it seems to be a pretty steady statistic. If you look at more severe kinds of abuse, you get a little bit of a, you know, lower incidence, but the one in four includes all kinds of things that, you know, might occur in the workplace, might occur in school. And what the other thing that that people often don't realize is the most common place for sexual abuse events to happen is in the privacy of your own home with a father, a stepfather, an uncle, a grandfather, partner of mother, or even mother and grandmother. There are also women that sexually abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a private thing. It happens in the context of families. And because it does, it is not really given the airtime that you really need, because there's so much pressure to cover it up from either the victim's loyalty to the family or society's loyalty to parents as custodians of children.
And when you say, let's be a little more specific here, all kinds of things happen, what are you talking about? How do we define abuse? What kinds of actions?
Oh, well, for example, you might include where a teacher might stop by a student's desk and put their hands inappropriately on a student. Now, sometimes that can happen, and depending on the student's reaction, that could escalate to a more intense kind of abuse, because that is called grooming. And what happens is an abuser sees what the reaction is from a mild interaction with somebody, or asking somebody to just keep a secret, or asking somebody inappropriately to spend private time with them. And if that vulnerable child seems to be the type who really craves that one-on-one attention and seems like they're going to develop a strong loyalty, then that's the kind of victim that a perpetrator wants to groom more. Now, in family situations, there's also grooming involved. So, for example, before the incident that Dylan Farrow describes, there's a description, if you look in the Vanity Fair article, there's a description of behaviors that Woody Allen was alleged to have engaged in that involved just not being able to leave her alone during her birthday party and other kinds of excessive private time spent. So those would be examples, if those are accurate, of grooming behaviors that lead to more abusive contact.
Mm-hmm.
And just to be really explicit, I think this, Kathleen, what you may have been getting at is we're talking about sexual assault of children. I mean, that is what's happening in families all over the country.
And you do a great deal of work, Kathleen, with the judicial system. Is it fair to say that the judicial system is doing a lousy job at protecting children's rights in this whole area? Or are they doing a fair job, or how are they responding?
Kathleen, the judicial system is completely broken. If you
really?
Yeah, if you look at how they are handling particularly child sex abuse cases. There's been some research on this issue, and the research shows that only 10% of children who are sexually abused are protected when their parents go through a divorce. So Dylan Farrow was very unique in that she's part of that 10% of kids who are protected, which means that the court does not allow the alleged perpetrator to have unsupervised contact or visits or partial or full custody with their victim. What we are seeing, and we get calls from all over the country, every state in the country, from parents who are trying to protect their children through the divorce courts, and they are very routinely and methodically losing custody of the child they're trying to protect to the alleged perpetrator, despite the fact that they bring hard evidence. They have ER doctors who are willing to testify to the fact that they believe the child has been molested. It's a real crisis, and it doesn't have to be that way. But what is the problem here, which we see in the Catholic Church pedophile scandal, which we saw with the Penn State scandal, as well as the Boy Scout scandal, is that you have an insular body, in this case a branch of government, where there is no accountability. There simply aren't checks and balances. So people are making a profit off of these cases when there's a child who's vulnerable and when there are allegations of abuse. So until we have any sort of accountability in the legal system, we will continue to see children harmed in this way.
So you're saying that the child who has been abused conceivably, and perhaps this happens more often than not, is still placed in the custody of the person who is doing the abusing?
That's
exactly right. I'm going to have to agree with Kathleen. And I'm one of the people who has studied this phenomenon. We have a research grant given to us through the Department of Justice to study this phenomenon, because it's come to the attention of our federal government that so many children who have been sexually abused have not been protected through our family court system. So the way that we studied the phenomenon was we looked at what we called turned around cases. So these are cases where children were ordered to live with abusive parents, and later a judge changed the court ruling and the children were later rescued. And so we have right now a sample of 54 cases from around the country. Now, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Those happen to be cases that have come to our attention, and they happen to be the ones in which the error was acknowledged so that we know that there was an error. And through this case-by-case analysis, we're able to see what the factors are that are leading to these false decisions and very dangerous decisions. And many of these factors are ones that will be familiar to people who have been reading about the Woody Allen and Dylan Farrow thing. Many of the much of the reasoning in the first decision is the same, the blaming of the mother for coaching, the blaming that the child can't distinguish fantasy from reality.
Mm-hmm.
There are many of these features which are very typical and which lead to these very, very dangerous judicial decisions.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about how widespread this is, and yet you find that these crimes are really underreported. There are a number of children who just don't say anything. They're probably traumatized and just feel that they can't, or they're told you can't say anything, or we won't give you love, we won't give you support, we won't give you a college degree or whatever. So this may be even a larger problem, alas, than we thought it was.
That's true, and we do find that when you interview people as adults, they say they did not tell when they were children. But the ones that really break my heart are where the children do tell, and they expect from telling that some good, loving adult is going to rescue them. And their mothers try to be that good, loving adult, and yet the system shuts them down and doesn't allow it to happen through blaming the mother for what the child disclosed. And then the child learns over time that no matter what, if you say anything, your mother's going to get in more and more and more and more trouble, to the point where the mothers are put on supervised visits or the mothers are jailed, so that the child learns that they lose their mother by telling the truth,
mm-hmm.
which is a terrifying situation.
Let's reference, we won't do this all hour, but so many people have paid close attention to Dylan and Woody's stories here. Woody Allen said in his piece in the New York Times, he and Mia Farrow were involved in a terribly acrimonious breakup with great enmity between us, a custody battle slowly gathering energy. The self-serving transparency of her malevolence seemed so obvious I didn't even hire a lawyer to defend myself. He subsequently found there were criminal charges and he had to get a criminal attorney to defend him. Is this a standard kind of thing that you would hear, that she is the one who put the charges in the mind of the 7-year-old child and it was out of the incredible bitterness of a custody battle?
Yes. This is in 90% of the cases that come to the Center for Judicial Excellence. A child is removed from their primary attachment figure, their caretaker, by the courts, because of this notion that one parent is pitting the child against the other. And therefore, say, you know, Susie doesn't want to go on her overnight or weekend visit with Daddy. Well, they will then say that it's the mother's fault for not forcing the little girl to go when she's terrified, instead of the fact that she doesn't want to go for legitimate reasons, that she's being harmed at Daddy's house, for instance. So this is a theory that goes back to the 80s. Dr. Richard Gardner created this theory called parental alienation syndrome. And fully 90% of the cases we hear about, the courts will accuse the safe parent who's trying to protect their child from sexual assault or molestation or rape. They will blame that parent for alienating the child against the other parent. This
mm-hmm.
theory has been discredited by the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association. Every credible legal and medical organization has debunked this as junk science, and yet it is being used in family courts all over the country. And you could see it in Woody Allen's defense in the New York Times, you know, this this, you know, accusation of fabricating of abuse allegations and coaching. So this is the most prevalent theory that's being used in family courts, despite the fact, again, that it's not even viewed as legitimate science. So that's where we say there's no accountability, because here you have the top legal organization saying it shouldn't be used in court, yet it's being used in courtrooms across the country.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Silber, what do you make of the very public nature of this particular case? The New York Times publishing both of these columns and then another column. Is this, what do you think of it? Is it a good thing for society at large because we're talking about the issue, or is it not? I've heard a lot of people say, I don't know who to believe in this.
I think it is a good thing. I think it is good that people can talk about it and they can see it in the light of day. I mean, for someone like Dylan Farrow, the public arena is her arena, because that's the arena in which Woody Allen is getting nominated for a prize. That's the arena in which he's getting accolades, and that's the arena where she feels like she needs to let everyone know that things aren't the way they seem. And I think it's nice that she's been given an opportunity to do that in a public way. And of course, seeing Woody Allen's response, it's certainly, to me, who's intimately familiar with the dynamics of cases like that, it's completely predictable. There's certain things that perpetrators will often do, including deny, make themselves as the victim, blame the partner, and say the person can't distinguish fantasy from reality. Some of it is just very, very typical. Of course, there's no way to know exactly what happened. Only the two of them have been there. But the dynamics are such that if you know these cases, it follows a pattern that people who are expert on this issue have seen multiple times.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls for our guests, and here's how you can reach this conversation. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. We're talking about child sexual abuse, which horribly is much, much more widespread in this country than you would like to believe it is. Our attention drawn to this because of what Dylan Farrow wrote in her op-ed in the New York Times, what Woody Allen wrote, what Dylan Farrow wrote again. And we're talking with two experts who have worked with young people who have been victims of sexual abuse and worked with the judicial system to allow them to move in a direction where they would protect children's rights in the system. Oh, my gosh, we got all our phone lines going in a second. So we have a lot of people who want to talk about this, which is good. Dr. Joanna Silberg is a therapist. She is senior consultant for child and adolescent trauma at Shepherd Pratt Health System in Baltimore. Her psychotherapy practice specializes in children and adolescents who are suffering from dissociative symptoms and disorders. Kathleen Russell is co-founder and director of the Center for Judicial Excellence in Marin County, California, and she advocates for changes that will promote judicial accountability and better protect children's and vulnerable populations' rights in the judicial system. To your phone calls, to your messages, all of that coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to our mini phone calls. Let's start with Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm listening closely to the conversation. There were two things that kind of stood out, and it was one was that all of the perpetrators of the sexual assaults are the fathers. Another was that 100% of these cases, the accusations are true and never found to be false. And I'd like to find out what percentage of the cases are actually perpetrated by the mother in a sexual abuse case, as well as how many of these cases are actually found to be factually false.
Okay. Who wants to start?
Sure,
Kathleen?
I can take on the false allegations issue. The fact of the matter is children hardly ever fabricate allegations of sexual abuse. studies analyzing maliciously fabricated allegations of child sex abuse have found that children bring only 0 to 2% of false allegations. So that means 98 to 100% of children's allegations are found to be credible.
And in terms of the perpetrators, it is overwhelmingly male, is it not, Doctor?
It is. Now, in our study of 54 cases, we have one female who is the perpetrator where the father is the protective parent, who the judge reverses back to the father after the mother is found to be abusive. And certainly in my practice, I've encountered multiple cases where women are the perpetrators, usually not sexual abuse, usually mothers are perpetrators of either neglect or physical abuse. If you look at records that are kept by the government, you will see that there's a very high percentage of women who are abusers. And the reason that the percentage is so high in the government statistics is because they're looking at families, and there are more women, single women, head of household families, than there are men, single household, single heads of families. So the numbers are skewed when you look at government statistics because of that. A lot of women who are single household families can be found to be neglectful and abusive. But in these custody issues where one is accusing the other, I've certainly found ones where mothers are the abusers, but the large percentage in my practice and what we've been able to discover in our study is the larger percentage is male abusers and female parents trying to be the protectors.
At what age does most of the abuse take place? Do we have an age? Is it very young? Is it adolescent?
No, it can start as early as infancy. I mean, we track these cases around the country, and it's very disheartening that infants under the age of one are often sexually abused, and so it goes through the age of the child.
Mm-hmm. Generally, by age 7 or 8, a child can give a believable report to social services that meets forensic criteria. However, they're able to tell people before 7 or 8. So what happens is they start to tell people maybe when they're 3 or 4 or 5, and then it's found non-substantiated. And it's found non-substantiated because it's very hard to do a good forensically sound interview with a child so young, because they may not know what truth means. The interviewer may not know how to developmentally appropriately interview them. They may get confused about details like time and date and season because they don't know those things. And then what happens is when they're 7 or 8 and they can give a good interview, they've had so many that were unsubstantiated that they're automatically ruled out when they're older. And this is something that I've been trying to educate people about for years, that just because you unfounded it when the child was younger, when they're finally able to give you a credible interview, that's not a time for you to rule it out, but to listen to what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. And it is. I've read some of your reporting on what you have to go through in a therapy session or a number of therapy sessions with a victim of child abuse, because it can be so traumatic that you block your memories of what had happened then, and it affects you in so many ways, but it's very hard to confront them again.
Depending on how close it is to the time of the abuse, if it is extremely close to the time of abuse, usually the defenses have, and it hasn't been a repeated thing, usually the defenses are not as built up and the child is more able to disclose. But if it's been repeated over time, let's say from the age of 2 through the age of 8, and the child has not been able to be believed, then they do have to segment it or dissociate it or keep it separate from their consciousness, at which point it is often very hard to get the children to let their minds remember it. As one of my clients said to me, I try to forget to remember. It hurts to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So their mind is working to try to push the negative content away because bringing it up hasn't been very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tom, for your call. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Good afternoon. Interesting program. I just find it almost incredible that that there's as much of this going on as it seems to be by the comments made so far. I'm wondering, I think people maybe have a stereotype in their mind of where this kind of abuse happens, and I'm wondering if it happens pretty much across the whole spectrum of society, economic, social, and so forth. And one further question, how often does the other spouse protect the perpetrator? Is this kind of, does this happen at all, or is it common?
Those are some good questions. Regarding the protection by another parent, that actually is what the old mythology was, that Child Protective Services was always kind of expecting, that the parents were going to be protecting one another. And that is, when Richard Gardner wrote his initial theories, he said that the first reaction of a mother is to automatically protect her spouse. And perhaps that is true, or that was true, but I believe that that is certainly changing, and there is much more willingness, maybe because divorce is more seen more as an option right now, and women have more economic choices. There is not the automatic loyalty that there might once have been, maybe even 50 or 60 years ago.
And in terms of where this happens, it is across all
Absolutely. You know. Rich, poor. You know, I always like to say that in my own state, that I would much rather testify about child abuse in my city, which has a lower socioeconomic status, than in the counties that have a higher one. Not because it's any more true or the incidence is any higher, but there tends to be the believability factor of the judges that they believe it's happening and they protect the children. But when I go to some of the wealthier counties and I testify regarding abuse, there is this automatic disbelief. How could a guy like that in a suit, you know, who has a really powerful job, how could that be true? He doesn't look like an abuser. And there is a definite resistance to accepting it in the higher socioeconomic classes, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask, because this is one issue that I just have a hard time understanding how anybody could not think that this was just absolutely wrong, that it was the wrong thing to do. The behavior is despicable and damaging. I don't understand how it can be so prevalent. Can somebody explain that to me?
Over time, there's a desensitization, and there's a lot of rationalizations that the perpetrators will tell themselves. So the rationalizations the perpetrators may use is that it feels good to the child, that the child really likes it, that the child started it, that it will help the child learn how to sexually express themselves in the future.
Oh my.
There's all kinds of rationalizations. And then there's also some people need increasing levels of breaking boundaries in order to be stimulated, and they will go for what's more and more and more on the edge. And over time, they desensitize themselves to the fact that they are breaking the boundaries.
Mm. Yeah, and I think we also have to look at the explosion of the child pornography crisis in this country and globally, because a lot of the child pornography is being fed by parents abusing their children. And so there is this problem that, you know, the internet has certainly wrought in terms of creating a pipeline or a demand for child sex abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an excellent point.
I do, too. Something we overlook. Thank you. We're overlooking the whole issue, I think. Dave, thank you very much for your call. Donna in Fitchburg. Hi.
Hi. I'm a divorced mom. I have two children. And my daughter, in the past couple of years, has had increasing problems going home to her dad's, to the point of panic attacks and all that. I don't think that there's any abuse going on, but I wonder, one thing she has said is that he's had like pornographic pictures up on the wall in his office at the home, and I know he didn't take these down before the kids came for the placement one time, and my daughter saw some pictures, and she started calling him a pervert and all that. And, again, I don't think he's done anything, but I wonder if just that image was enough to freak her out.
Dr. Silberg.
I certainly think it's possible the image was enough, but also I think that a person who would not realize to protect his child from exposure to that kind of thing probably lacks a certain amount of empathic connection to the child and probably does other things that show a disregard for her feelings or a lack of sensitivity to where she is developmentally. So I would say it probably is not just that one picture. It's probably a pattern of behavior, and children are very sensitive to whether parents perceive their needs, whether parents do things on purpose, what a parent's mental state is when they engage in things that are not pleasant for the child. So she's probably very tuned in and very aware that in whatever way you're sensitive to her needs and take her needs as number one priority, when she's there, that's not happening.
Is there a way to get her to talk about why she feels so uncomfortable?
You might bring her to a therapist,
right,
and have the therapist talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
Cannot stand her dad.
Yeah.
And just won't talk.
So. Mm. What about the idea?
If she has to keep going, it's not really safe to express her feelings about hating him too much. But if there's
he's been able to make adjustments so that she's only over there every other week for one night. That's all.
Uh-huh.
But even that, she absolutely hates.
And have you thought about talking to somebody about all of this, Donna?
I have.
It might be a good thing, huh?
Mm-hmm. And I just, I don't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm. I would
kids know where
joy.
True love is.
Kathleen?
Yeah, I would concur with Joy about having your daughter speak with someone. I will caution you that we see this time and again in cases where a mother or a father hears the child's being harmed and decides to start documenting. And this was an issue in the Dylan Farrow case where the mother videotaped a confession from the daughter. And a lot of times those can be used against you in family court. So it's very important that you have mandated reporters, so a school principal or a teacher or a therapist that the child confides in, and not just you as a parent, because should there be something going on, and we don't know that there is in your case, but should there be and you end up in divorce court, the very nature of your daughter confiding in you can be used against you to take her away from you and put her with the dangerous parent. So it's very important as you're dealing with these situations. They're extremely delicate. And what you think is common sense around how the court would handle these situations, it gets turned on its head in family court. It's like we refer to it as Alice in Wonderland, and things simply don't make sense in terms of protecting children. So I would really emphasize talking to mandated reporters who are in your child's life, what any adult that, is required by state law to report when confessions are made.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Donna, for your call. John in Janesville.
Yeah, I'm a little upset with this because I happen to be a victim of false allegations. I ended up spending 6 months in prison, gotten beaten up 4 or 5 times because my ex-wife accused me of molesting my daughter, which was later through her mother, who she finally confessed to her mother that it was all lies. My parents died thinking I was a pedophile. Don't tell me women don't use it. I ended up having custody of my children, all my children, and she ended up having none. Also, too, when you start quoting these quotes, you ought to realize that 80 women are 8 times more prone to molesting their children than women. Now, that's all molestation, physical and mental. Also, too, 70% of the women are the ones that kill their children. So when you sit back and you start talking about this and you're talking about Dylan and you say all these things don't happen, yes, they do. I happen to be an officer in a club of men who have been falsely accused of sexual taking sexual advantage of their children, being pedophiles. So if you're going to quote the things, quote them adequately. Don't sit back and say, oh, this poor Dylan, because right now it's Dylan's word and it's his word. I think he probably did it myself personally. But, you know, you got to stop being so sexually biased when you're reporting this stuff. It's absolutely absurd.
Dr.
Could
Silver,
I ask the
yes.
gentleman a question?
I was a pedophile. Yeah.
Can you,
because I had a woman.
All right, John, if you could just answer a question from one of our guests, please.
This is Dr. Silver. I was just wondering, what is it about the case of Dylan and Woody Allen that makes you believe that he probably did it? Because that could be very instructive to compare with.
Because I have actually been around people who have done it and claim they didn't, and I've been around people who claim that this is all falsified, and he follows to me. And this happened to me 30 years ago. And I have followed this rather religiously for 30 years, and over those 30 years, I've been able to formulate pretty much by the way people discuss things whether or not they're guilty. And in my point, he is guilty of sin.
What is it about the way he discusses it that makes you think he might be guilty?
Did you hear that, John? John is gone. I don't know what happened. He's gone.
Okay, well, I think he brings up a really important point that I've also found in my work, that people who truly are falsely accused act very differently from the ones who just say they're falsely accused. And I think it's really amazing if John is able to discern it from him having spent a lot of time with people who either claim to be falsely accused or who are falsely accused. Now, in my practice, for example, people who are truly falsely accused really want an expert in child sexual abuse to evaluate their child. They come to me. They say, you're the expert. I want to know who's doing this because I know it's not me and this child shouldn't have these symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas somebody who is just claiming to be falsely accused stays as far away as possible from any experts and goes to only experts who don't specialize in sexual abuse but who specialize in false accusations. That would be like if you think you have cancer, only going to doctors who have never seen cancer because you're afraid they might find it in you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the ways that I tell the difference. Of course, I don't know what happened with this gentleman. And, you know, he said it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, we didn't know as much about the signs and symptoms of abuse. And it could be that the prosecution was more zealous in those days. I don't really know. But in today's world, prosecution of child sexual abuse is not zealous at all. They go for numbers. They want beyond a reasonable doubt if they're bringing a case. If all they have is a child witness, they know they don't have beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's very unlikely. I believe the statistic is only 4% of any founded cases of abuse end up in our criminal justice system.
Mm. Thanks for the call, John. Let's welcome more phone calls. We have a couple lines open now. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about child sexual abuse this hour of the show, how often we see it in our society, whether or not children fabricate allegations of sexual abuse, how often that happens, maliciously fabricated allegations that come from the party, maybe they're in a custody battle. How often does that happen? Is it perpetrated more by males than females? How are victims treated in the judicial system? All of that is up for conversation this hour of the program. Our guests are Dr. Joanna Silberg. She is a psychotherapist whose practice specializes in children and adolescents suffering from dissociative symptoms and disorders, and her forensic practice specializes in child sexual abuse. Also joining us is Kathleen Russell, Executive Director of the Center for Judicial Excellence in Marin County, California. She advocates on behalf of the Center for legislative and administrative changes that will promote judicial accountability and better protect legislative and administrative changes that will better protect children and vulnerable populations. More phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Talk at WPR.org is the way to get a message to us as well. Joe in Madison, hi.
Hi there. I don't have a question, just a quick tale. I'll do the best I can to make it brief. I was molested by my older brother, my only sibling, probably from like ages 4 to 5th grade. Of course, with that comes a lot of guilt, because when something like that goes on, the victim becomes complicit and therefore has a lot of guilt over that. It stopped when I was in 5th grade, probably because that was his first sexual girlfriend. So I never worried about it too much, just figured, you know, I was the only one in the home for him to let out these urges, and so basically was kind of an only child in a way. My wife, who I've known for 10 years now, was one of four sisters whose father molested all four sisters. Now, the oldest one made an accusation and, you know, was declined or whatever. So after she moved out of the house when she became of age, she found out that this was going on with my wife and the other two sisters, and you know, really brought on all forces and put the father away for a couple years.
Oh,
now, I was not diagnosed with my OCD and my bipolar and ADHD until around age 40, when I was doing a successful career and everything. So I'm on the meds, and I've been doing psychotherapy since then. That's about 12 years or so. And, of course, this came up and has been looked into a lot between my therapist and I. One time I was trying to figure out some of the conflicts between my wife and I in the marriage, and I wrote down what was the difference between our two cases. And in mine, the major differences was, well, mine was an older sibling, still a caretaker, but was the same gender. And, you know, I'm not bisexual, I'm heterosexual, and, of course, that makes it a big secret. And my parents still don't know. They're in their 80s.
Oh.
They did a good job. There's no way I want to bring them down with this. It would kill them.
Mm-hmm.
So I held this secret all my life, and also have been quite obsessive about honesty in my relationships. I figure that's because the one secret's enough for this guy to handle.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, on the other hand, was outed. And so I think she's real scared about humiliation and embarrassment and stuff like that. And I just wondered if you could comment on the possible characteristics, psychotherapy kind, the psychological kind that come from our differences.
Dr. Silber.
Well, that was it sounds like you already have a huge amount of insight about what's happened with you and what's happened with your wife. One thing that I picked up just as you were talking was when you used the word complicit, and I hope and I think you understand that you were not complicit, but if you don't understand that yet, I want to be sure you do understand that you were younger, and that's an exploitation of the power difference, that you perceived yourself as complicit, and he might have used that in order to keep you quiet. But in reality, you were a victim of somebody more powerful who was exploiting you. And it's possible that it's difficult to break yourself free of that sense of guilt, in part because you've had to maintain that secret for such a long time, and you've had to protect your parents, and you felt it's your obligation to protect your parents, and there's just no place for that anger to go except kind of against your own self. So your wife, in a way, although she's fearful of humiliation and shame, may in some ways feel more liberated from guilt than you are because of the fact that she's had the public opportunity to see that the perpetrator really, really is the responsible one. And you've really never been able to see that in reality.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe, and all the best to you. Continue.
Thank you for being
growth.
So brave to
yes.
talk about this.
Yes, thank you. Boots in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, Hey, good afternoon. I have a statement and an inquiry, I guess. A book that I read that was phenomenal in expressing why people make the decisions they do and then justify their behavior was a book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not by Me, by Elliot Aronson and Carol Tavrist. And it talks about these little increments, somewhat like what you were talking about, is people kind of test the water with little cross over the line of appropriateness. And then when they get a positive reinforcement, they just kind of keep on going further and further. And there's a part in the book that talks about therapists, and I think it was called suppressed memory or something from back in the 70s or something, and how some therapies actually convinced people that they were abused by their parents. And there were many cases of parents that were not abusers that ended up being found guilty.
All right, let's get a response. Dr. Silberg.
We don't really know if that's true. There's certainly a mythology in our culture that tells us that's true. But we truly don't know how often it is that therapists, in fact, have created it. Now, there was an organization that still exists. It's called the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. And that foundation claims that its members were falsely accused of child abuse by their children. But just as that gentleman who called us earlier who told us he's in groups for falsely accused, but some of them really, you know, aren't falsely accused, we have no way of knowing in the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, just because they say they're falsely accused, whether they really are. One study showed that 60% of them had been actually charged with crimes. So we just simply don't know how often that happens. There are people that promote that mythology that therapists are the ones that create it.
Yes.
In my practice, I don't see that. In my practice, when people disclose abuse, they've been holding on to these feelings for quite a long time, and then they finally tell things. And the idea of repressed memories, although words have changed, it's called dissociative amnesia or inaccessible memory or other kinds of more scientific words. That concept has been validated scientifically. It does happen that people do not have access to memories that later they do get access to in time. So there still is a scientific debate over what the mechanism is. Is it a mechanism involving dissociation or repression, or cognitive science has other words for it called motivated forgetting? So there's all kinds of scientific explanations of why it is that happens. But there's really no scientific dispute that fit memories of things that occurred when you were younger, you can have little access to, and then something can trigger their reawakening,
mm-hmm.
a smell, an experience, an idea, confrontation with a child of the same age you were. Things like that can bring it back to consciousness.
Kathleen, we just have about 35 seconds left. What could courts do right now that would promote getting at the truth in these cases?
Well, courts need to listen to children, and we passed a law in California that really should be nationwide by state that gives children an opportunity to speak to judges who are making these all-important decisions about where they get to live and be for the rest of their lives. So we also, for anyone who's interested in making change in the system, our organization and others have a petition on change.org to demand congressional oversight hearings on the broken family court system, and that can be found on our website at www.centerforjudicialexcellence.org.
Thank you both so much for being with us. We are flooded with phone calls and emails. We couldn't get to all of them, but we thank you very much for all of your information, and it's obvious we have more to learn. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Our thanks to Dr. Joanna Silberg. She is a therapist, and her practice specializes in children and adolescents, forensic practice, and child sexual abuse. Kathleen Russell, executive director of the Center for Judicial Excellence in Marin County, California. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this show and for doing all our production on air here in downtown Milwaukee, and thanks to our guests. I'm sorry we couldn't get to you, all of you. We had too many emails and phone calls. We would have loved to, and we'll do a follow-up. Tomorrow, during this time period, we'll talk about the tenure track. Another hour coming up for us.